we'd just like to remind you that there are just a couple of rules. We do want you to feel free to get up and order a drink, or even to use the restroom. Please feel free to do that. But try to be courteous of the readers. We'll change in the middle, but there won't be a break.
And also, do remember to turn off those cell phones. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Ramsey Matthews to introduce Alexa Doran.
Shaw for this lunch.
You're welcome.
As each of us go through life, we meet hundreds and hundreds of people, and if we are a teacher or a Walmart sales clerk, we meet thousands. Occasionally, rarely, we meet a person who adds depth to our life and helps us calibrate our worldview a click or two in the positive direction. Alexa Doran is such a person in my life. We met in summer 2016 as she was starting her PhD career at FSU, taking the six-week competition pedagogy boot camp. I taught ENC 2135 that summer, and Alexa sat in my classroom for 4 weeks as my mentee. That's a noun, not a mentee. Mentee. Such a strange word that implies I was a mentor, but I believe the reason Alexa was placed in my class, besides fate, becoming great friends, was for her to witness what not to do in the classroom by watching me. Over the years since that summer, several of her students turned up in my upper-level lit classes. They told me she was an extraordinary and gifted teacher, and she prepared them for the rigors of academic work at FSU. On Tuesday, November 13th, a couple of months from now, Alexa starts with 3 days of preliminary exams, which she has been studying for all year. Those of you who have faced the prelim beats or are soon anticipating walking into that lion's den know the psychological, spiritual, physical, and intellectual toll the process inflicts. I just had this conversation with Phil. The exams are a major step in the PhD process. But I'm here to tell you that Alexa already has a PhD. She earned a PhD in motherhood. I've often been called a compound noun that begins with mother and ends with a derogatory gerund, mother, but I will never earn a PhD in motherhood. There are several women in this program, Paige, who has done just that either right before or after starting the PhD coursework. I have no right to complain, and neither do any of you, about the difficulties of the PhD while standing in the presence of such women.
Right.
Alexa's Twitter description is lyrical gangster, mom, poet. I would edit this to warrior queen, mother, and gangster poet. Only a ninja poetess mother such as Alexa would have the balls to name her son Dante. The 13th century Italian poet Dante gave the world his extraordinary Divine Comedy, which describes Dante's travels through hell, purgatory, and paradise. I will now recite the entire Inferno in Latin, and I'm asking for volunteer readers. Here's one quote attributed to Dante. The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis. Social media provides a lazy outlet for complainers to sit on the couch and twiddle their thumbs. Tallahassee is the capital of Florida, with the governor and the legislature right up the street. Alexa regularly attends rallies at the state capitol, including the protests for gun control after the Parkland High School shooting. She takes the young activist, her 2.5-year-old son Dante, who is right here, with her. That's him speaking. She uses her social media to post fun memes, such as, do something with your life that would make a 1950s straight white man angry. Or, shout out to all the moms and dads who are living with the horror of America right now, whose children have been to more protests than playgrounds, whose children are afraid of public spaces because the guns, the cages, the rampant racism. Alexa is a troublemaker with a capital T. You want her on your side, otherwise don't get in her way. Especially don't get between Alexa and Dante. Alexa reads or has read poetry for Nightjar Review and the Southeast Review. She recently published in Guernica, Queen Mom's Tea House, The Mom Egg, Gigantic Sequins, and the Matt Neese Review, and has work forthcoming in Vice Magazine and Glass Poetry Press. Been a finalist for first place at least 7 times in this past summer, attended the Martha's Vineyard Creative Writing Institute workshop as a parent and fellow. One other PhD I forgot to mention that you would know about if you followed her on Facebook or Twitter, is that Alexa already has a PhD in duck lip selfies. Please welcome my badass friend, Alexa Doran.
Beautiful, and I'm purposely using the word fucking because Eleanor is worried about swearing in front of my kids. But I love language, I love all language, so feel free to use whatever language you want. Okay, so thank you so much for coming to be here tonight and spending some of your evening with Dorsey and I's poetry. I know we both extremely, extremely appreciate it. I also extremely appreciate that Ramsey has left the microphone exactly where I need it. This project that I'm going to share with you tonight started 2 years ago for me. In my very first class at FSU, my very first workshop at FSU, my very first experience as a PhD anything, in which I attempted to bring the very first poem that I had written about my son to workshop. I say attempted because it did not work out. In the middle of it, I started racking sobs and had to leave the classroom. The immediate consensus was that my son had died, but since he just left screaming, I guess we can all decide that he's all alive. He's alive. Great. So what I realized later on was that crying wasn't because he died, but because it was a really powerful experience to put how I felt about my son into words on a sheet of paper. Despite the fact that everyone couldn't understand the tears not being related to death. But either way, that's why I'm here now. I couldn't let go of the power, I think, which many of us feel. I couldn't let go of the power that I felt when I wrote about my son. And so that brings me to my very first poem, I Am Failing You. Okay, I am failing you. Here, you can see it in my hand. The way when air fails smoke, it wends ash. A mother's silence has velocity, wing speed, and at 32, I'm still learning to speak. I say hurdle, but mean throat. I mean sincerely, you can jump right over me, stun me with dust, and I will still bunny go. Son, I already have so many roles, dustbuster, kiss crafter, forever disciple of my first dance teacher, Miss Trudeau. I know, mourning becomes a chalice when least expected. So why can't I resurrect into something you can sip on the go? My mother used to pause the screen on all the ice skating queens as they waited for their number to glow. You can't fake grace, she said. There. Watch her sparkle-shot lips fold. Her two big eyes glimpse God, her bun twitch against the faux snow. What I mean is, climb up on the moss with me. As equals, in this quiver of ether, we can bereave the mother-child trope. What I mean is, melt into the peat. Use your ankles to breathe. the bog is not a big rink for us to glacier each other's feet. No, it doesn't matter in what order we grow. Graze your first taste of champagne. Now, touch your toes. Okay, this next poem I have is called The Neighbors Invite Us to Church. But with full disclosure that it is not about my neighbors, any neighbors that I have had would never have invited me to church. Almost all neighbors I have tried to have me have arrested. They have not succeeded. They have not succeeded. But anyways, the neighbors here are representative. The neighbors invite us to church. Unless we forget the petrified look on my face, the downtown sprinklers a jazz all around me, my son more abuzz than June on the concrete, let us conjure the fear that freckled my face that day. How many of us crumple as if God were a gust that could knock us down with an accident of touch? I'm not sure I want my son to see that side of him, his feet tucked beneath a pew, his tongue tucked beneath a hand, when right now, God's everything. I mean, I still want him to feel the thorn glut his forehead, to stitch his skin, now numb, to loop his mouth around the language of crucifixion. But at what cost? The blazer-buried prayer, the pulpit clunk resounding louder than the robin beak drilling song into air. My son's face puddles in the fountain's reflection. A trillion versions of him blend and drag. I nod politely and say, I will never be ready to give religion circumference. Let God be a lily pad instead. A pause on the water, a point of departure, agreeing without end. The next poem that I'll share with you comes from my obsession with the reality TV show Hoarders. Some call it vanity. Before you were born, I binge-watched Hoarders. The hours ample as the antelope I imagine trampling me whenever I forget to dream. I wish women wear nothing but yellow as they brick themselves in Barbies, little forms of soulless bodies, loneliness in the shape of lip balm, and a few prize-winning doilies, men who sang celebrating songs to rats named Adolphus, and then. Some I watched them, and I did not love them. I saw their weariness wick and bubble and did not budge. I had not yet layered that champagne glass with their sunshine striated locks, or cut a swath from the cushion where your head sweat once blossomed, did not understand that barriers could be built from your residue. Love is forever a holding on to. So how come they beseech me to let go? No more umbilical cord crust mummified by the bedpost. No more quilt of spit-up rags. No more quilt of spit-up rags stitched above the bureau. They don't want to believe love is obscene. They want the pink pattern of moderation. Lips to ease off of lips. Breath to exist as a poised pant. The perfect counterpart to the soft parlay of a kiss. But son, I'm sloppy with lists, and I refuse to contain any of it. So let Florida, the Florida morning, file across your cheeks, turn to me, and babble not words, but the moonlight that seeps through the spokes of your bridge, your voice, the uncease of lunar heat. This last poem that I'm going to share is the oldest poem in the series that I've written. And I share it only because I'm still winning this argument a year later. They want you to sleep in a different bed. Oh, buggy, this is where it begins. The clunk of the crimson paneling you bang against my face. The lover you tell me tastes like mocha. So much bean froth between her legs, it feels like cloth. It feels like lace. I know what they all say. They think I'm easily replaced. How quickly the pink shoot of your mouth will fade from the fountain of my nipples and fasten to some queen who has forgotten who holds the ace. The one who gave you your first taste of female flesh and wombscape. I've already found the rags, stiff with your 16-year-old semen, the whoosh of a zipping gym bag, the cell phone flap against your face, already cleaving all I have of you, the space. I don't want to have to meet you on the page. I want the warm bustle of your body to bank against me, the sheets spread out like waves. And this next poem that I'll be sharing comes after watching one of my favorite episodes of Elmo's World, in which the little girl identifies all the different nostrils on all the different animals, and then she sees a whale, and she's like, whoa-ho, that's not a nostril. I adore it. Dawn is a sound Dante makes. The llamas from my dream still have your flesh in their teeth as the sheets crenellate between you and the sour haze hammock behind my knees. You reach for me, and a relic from last night's scene, counting nostrils and blowholes on Sesame Street, it takes hold of me. What is it about the walk-walk that makes you happy, the strut, the moo, the feather spume that turns your fist, the five-part parts that pulse in five arcs for a language that's not ours? What do you hear in nay that you never heard in a thousand cordial days? I can hear my lesbian Barbie, the mascot for my childhood lacrosse team. Not God, exactly, but the only one who used to speak to me. Her flamingo pink bikini feathering my fingers like a rosary. Is that why you communicate in cock-a-doodle-doos? More than mom, animals have ears built to hear you. Beakless, I admit, I curve into your wings. Another milk stripe across your downy skin and listen for your first rattle to settle in. This next poem's inspiration comes somewhat less from my son than from an interior decorating magazine, which suggested that instead of bachelor's caves or whatever they call them, man cave? Yeah, instead of a man cave, that I should have a she shed. Dimensions for building a sun. Someone suggests a she shed. A fissure in the forest labeled no man, a secret sort of chamber where I chisel him from maple and forest phlegm. Then my mother sends a cupcake tin, a dozen pink sleeves to aster his skin. Does she really believe a child must rise or die? Sometimes I think nothing less than a coven could raise him, a carousel of witch lips to shape his abdomen. Embossed in a crow-tinged accent, he would fly past the apple scream of puberty, an arrow free from its sheath. As you see, I'm open to suggestions, since lately I dream in draft cards and swollen peak. Wouldn't it be easier to let his father cock him like a window, to let the wax wrapped the butcher sheet define his proportions for me? Bright red lines where his heart should be. But where would the jazz reach if I let some other man define the span of my son's ability? I think I'll take a crocus and cup his knees. Let the pollen pick which limb to seed. Isn't that my job? To vein the errand and pollen sobs and breathe? Okay, this next poem is after visiting our local zoo on the bridge of the Black Bear exhibit. I ask myself what the fuck I'm really doing here. Slalling my son's stroller down a path, shellacked in alligators and purple swamp grass, can I still claim that my aim is to educate my son? At best, the Black Bear will be a speck of char buried in the nettle and distance. At worst, she'll be a black bear. 7 feet of curiosity and hunger barreling forth. What's the lesson? Last week in the ocean, my son shot forth, his body an arrow of foam on the waves. I was the only one that was afraid. Son, am I using the zoo to prime you for the vicious and wild blue of a time when I'll only be residue? Is there anything more pathetic than a mother who's pulled her son from the la-la grip of the playground and plugged him into a scene so Victorian level creepy that even the stumps that protrude through the creek are acid orange warnings of what lies beneath? When I was 11, I was light as a feather, stiff as a board. I believed the magic would eventually come easy, just like maternity, but I can't levitate now any more than I can make my son proud. So if you happen to be a mother who knows the perfect dose to keep your son afraid, but not necessarily at bay, this is my Mayday. Or maybe I just need to turn on the TV and show him the KKK. The last poem that I'll be sharing with you tonight is as much a dedication to my son as to one of my idols, Britney Spears. It's called Baby, Hit Me One More Time. Pondering life and pop and locking to Tupac, pretending to blend in with my students, I park the family sedan and find myself at a strange juncture. Does MTV Summer Beach Party still exist? I mean, can I still catch myself in the curl breath of Ananda Lewis? Can I still forest the land of tan abdomens and cocaine-colored sand? What mother doesn't want to sign up for the sand slobber, the class-action coochie call to Carson Daly, to feel the gaudy microphone slip across her thigh? Waterlogged by the nostalgic, I am the juicy bit of midlife crisis that every mother with a stepmother forgot could cry. Who is to say my son would not feel proud to see his mother dough along the pier, a slosh of sunset and gin in her wake, crisp as a fawn, faux as the horizon. Thank you so much.
Let's have another round of applause for Alexa. And please join me in welcoming our next introducer, Eleanor Boudreau.
The Venn diagram of poets who can write convincingly and unnervingly about an 18th century pirate named Anne Bonny and a 21st century sorority initiation for ninth grade girls is literally a circle. And it's a circle of one, Dorsey Kraft. When I agreed to do this introduction, I promised that I would not compare Dorsey's poetry to Walt Whitman's, but I left. Dorsey's speaker is like Whitman because she embraces her contradictions. She is both a joiner and a rebel, a sorority sister, and a woman who looks to an iconoclast, the most famous female pirate of all time, as a model for how to live and what to do, as her chosen mother, the point of her own self-inception. She is both a beauty and a woman whose revelry in her body's excesses and excrescences causes her biological mother to say, "You're letting yourself go." In a poem early in Dorsey's manuscript, her teenage speaker plays soccer with a group of boys, and the boys push her around the field. They buffet and bruise her without any apparent effort or even thought. And this becomes a metaphor for all of life's tests and contests where men experience greater freedom and success. But let me remind everyone that on this pitch we're all playing on this mortal plane, no one gets out of here alive, and no one gets to take anything with them. It often seems to me that fate is saying, "Congratulations, gentlemen, but also fuck you. Because we're not playing a zero-sum game. We're playing a zero-zero game. At some terminal point, all anyone of any gender gets to say is once I use my body and my mind. Despite the stark backdrop, the language in Dorsey's poems is luxuriant, but like all luxury, it is something she has paid a high price for. Dorsey's speaker is a pirate on the seas of the unconscious. She has plundered experience and fantasy for these words, and she has taken in what isn't hers. To the point where, in Ode to Sex in the City, Dorsey's speaker watches Carrie Bradshaw, dressed as always in an absurd outfit, traverse New York City, and she can't tell where this ridiculous cutout of femininity stops and where her genuine experience begins. "Can you tell I've never been to New York City?" she asks. She can no longer locate herself. At the end of this ode, the speaker wishes not for a location or even a coherent identity, but for punctuation. She looks at Carrie smoking a cigarette and envies her this semicolon carcinogen, which is just a literary way of saying she wants a break. And she wants to insert some order into the monstrous and chaotic catalog that is existence. But her life is punctuated by menstrual periods, by hunger and lust, and by the knowledge that at any moment her seemingly robust body may betray her and or, I don't think the speaker knows which, become pregnant. And this is the biggest contradiction that a writer must embrace. The ability to reproduce life, life which despite its enormous varieties is also always terminal. To make is to make end. To light is to extinguish. There is no such thing as a perpetual text. I'd like to note that up until this moment, which is the end of my introduction, this has been a very dire preamble. And that's because I'm doing it, okay? I am a dire girl. Always have. Always looking. For myself.
Yes.
But Dorsey's speaker actually isn't like that, okay? She sees what I see, okay? She sees what I see. This is all there in her manuscript. But her reaction isn't nearly as dismal or harsh. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and this is really what I admire most about Dorsey's work. Dorsey's speaker, she's so different from myself. And as simply as I can put a complicated thought, I think it's this. The woman we encounter in Dorsey's poems has the courage of her desires, which is a rare quality. And she's also capable of being in and living out her desires without losing her convictions, which is rarer still. Dorsey holds an MFA from McNeese State University. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Crab Orchard Review, the Massachusetts Review, Mid-American Review, Rhino Poetry, and others. She was also a finalist for the Autumn House Rising Writer Contest and a semifinalist for the Crab Orchard First Book Award. She's a loyal friend and a terrific tennis partner. She loves dogs with unabashed abandon, especially corgis. She wears tiger stripes better than I can. More than 2 years ago, we were at the Admitted Students Welcome Weekend, and Dorsey said to me that the goal was to become a hot doctor. So you're more than halfway there, Dorsey. I'm going to stop saying nice things so we can all hear some killer poems. Please join me in welcoming to the stage, Dorsey Kraft.
Gorgeous introduction.
My first poem is going to be an Anne Bonny poem. It's called Anne Bonny and I Aboard the Cruise Ship. You completely botch the muster drill, swing in from behind the lifeboats without either form of ID, and miss the children who clutch at their plastic barcode bracelets. So we have to make a quick break away from my open-mouthed in-laws. You can't see why they stand in lines, particularly when the sea slips by so many yards beneath. And why have they built the ship so high? No spray, no wayward tuna leaping into your arms, no brace in your back as the waves beat their gunshot rhythm on the hull. Just a drunken shift of the floor, not enough to ruffle the wine that spills from bottle after bottle at state dinners, where the women tie their torsos in thin black straps and sip while the men are ordering double the appetizer, double the entree, hunks of fried octopus and crabs stuffed with chives, and you cannot figure how they keep it all, or where they lay the long lines to catch these bottom dwellers, or how they've trapped crystal water on the deck where the pale chlorine waves flap like ocean's dying breath. But you shrug and stack your arms with diamond cuffs anyway, determined to plunder the windows that sit unguarded, bursting with pearl, to drape your body in silks and taffetas from brimming racks that fill even as soon as you've made off with the wares. And we jog so many ovals on the upper deck track, you backwards and chugging champagne and winking at the lines of bikini girls in deck chairs like brittle starfish in sun, but smelling coconut fresh. By this time, we've lost my in-laws, and the ship attendants have been informed to keep an eye out for two drunk women in feathers racing through the halls like mackerel, turning staterooms upside down, looking always for some scrap of gold that will be missed. This next one is about when I met my man, my husband. The first few months we were dating, we just sort of like shirked every responsibility, including our personal hygiene. I miss it really badly when we were gross together. So this is called Love Poem with Grease and Silver. When we kept stuffing condoms in the empty bedside tissue box, their filmy corpses oozed rotten dogwood and left rancid grease on the cardboard bottom. When the slithery, damp armpits of my silk-going-out tops were crushed under heavy mounds of your jeans. When I wriggled ripe thighs into those loose legs and we went for pizza, twinned and reeking solid, hot breath. Every day that year, I inhaled the dirty youth of your body. Each crevice of nail and dollop of clay, crevice of navel and dollop of clay beneath nail, and toss of aftershave snagged my breath in winter like cheap hose. And I let my silver necklace tarnish as though I dipped the full length down the drain, ceased applying nightly masks, and barely blinked when my mother finally said, "You're letting yourself go." And I kept on going to see how you shuddered when I swished the contact lens in my mouth before replacing it in the delicate film of my iris, gasped and gripped my bare shoulder and shook with disgust. And I learned how you feared eyes, how you could not share a sidewalk with an umbrella or pry your lids for the optometrist, but not so much as a cringe these days when I fill the sterile cups with solution and pluck the lenses out for night, slip the light before I fold into you. Even back then, though, I hated how greasy our hair would get, so I'd coax you to shower every so often, four bare feet on tile, and all that caked our bodies would rush now, and we'd climb dripping into that lofted twin that bobbed like a leaf in an icy stream, with us clasped and clutching on top
warming under sheets, beginning to rebuild the layer that fused my body to yours. Did you guys, people who are my age, play Neopets when you were
there?
Yeah, I did too when I was in like fifth grade. And I would wake up at 5 a.m. to feed those little dudes. Yeah, but while I was doing that, I was also being super sketchy on the internet. So that's kind of what this poem is about. It's called My Father's Face. When my father was a boy, he flew on two wheels and roar and Icarus with a collarbone like a canary and auburn forehead. The seat must have rumbled between his thighs, the motors growl against his scrotum, a more dense and thorny pleasure even, then slipping forward and back along the grit of the bathtub floor until the water sloshed or pressing again into the deflated couch cushions. Nothing like my own early mornings in chat rooms, tabs switched from bright blue games at our kitchen desktop to what would you do for me and are you hard now from strangers. Sometimes I was a hard man, though soft was not the female term I learned, but never guessed that wet would be correct. Woman was easier, say yes and be naked in my double XL t-shirt until my father ambled in to fry a bacon. I'd close the browser and butter the toast. 12 years old, my father crested a hill and shot into the sky. His brother met him there, a mash of flesh and metal that left his jaw a tattered wing after a spray of shot. Feathers of muscle and skin across his chin, a nose, a drooping neck, and closed gray eyelid. Being called a woman for the first time is a memorable thing. And so my father still recalls the smack of laughter from down the stairs when he shouted my face, my goddamn face, into the oval mirror. Light from a bare bulb, he flicked dark, quick as a stitch. I wrote this poem this summer when I was dabbling in prelim reading. When I was reading Ovid, and it seemed just like every couple of pages, some woman is getting turned into like a tree or a cow or a bird or whatever. It's called I Bring Home a Lemon Tree. I bring home a lemon tree in a yellow bucket, and it burns in the sun like a blonde. The edges of its leaves frizzle back in a dog's bare snarl. In the fall, the fruit drops like tears. If this poem were Ovid's, my lemon tree would be a maiden nymph chased into my yard by a god. Peach girl and lime woman, grapefruit babe and pear chick, linger in cliques at the garden emporium where I buy 8 bales of pine straw to protect my flower bed's modesty. When I bend to spread this brittle fleece, no voice whispers from bushes, no swallow with lust in its beak descends a sun-specked staircase. Despite my racerback tank top, which once drew a mustache with legs, to ask me to get off the treadmill, leave this gym, you're sweating everywhere. It's not your shoulders, really, not your breasts either, just the germs we're worried about. And it's true, I never use those ill-fated towels in the bins. I'm happy to absorb everybody, to have their cardio funk mingle with the root dirt still clung to the grooves of my palms. The smooth gold rinds of lemons don't moisten like skin. They only get wet when rain licks Florida and bathes them in showers sultry as shampoo commercials. If they could sweat, I'd drink it straight from the hose. If my tree is a woman, her hair hangs in her eyes. Water spins in the rain. While I was reading the Ovid, I was also watching a lot of Sex and the City. So to be fair to like both of these great texts, the episode where Carrie's nude strapless dress is ruched all sparkly down the bodice and hangs in mummy bandages from her crotch to her ankles. Those skinny knees pop in and out of sight in rhythm like manic tan birds in a cuckoo clock. She is at a wedding. She is reading a poem about love. If my friends asked me to write a poem for their wedding, I'd likely cut my hair and dye it Miranda red, drive down I-10 to Louisiana and get a blue thigh tattoo of the fleur-de-lis. And sure, Carrie's scared, but she's still blonde, corkscrews, and untattooed as far as I know. It's only season 2 and I'm on my first binge watch. Predicted plot twist. The ladies grow claws and beaks and rip intestines from unworthy suitors in broad daylight, then rendezvous at chic rooftop venues for chai lattes or whatever they were drinking in early aughts New York. Season 4 takes place entirely feathered, and nests are lined with $200 haircut clippings, occasional verse for egg smashings, and ripples in street puddles. Can you tell I've never been to New York? My favorite friend from high school owns her own restaurant with her boyfriend and works for Procter & Gamble. She's throwing her wedding bash for herself there, even though she lives in Cincinnati. So I guess I'll finally get to see those big-ass buildings, gray and gray and gray. I hope she wears a red dress, an ostrich feather train, a hairpiece that sprays like a fountain. I hope we skip the fake send-off, sparklers and confetti, and poses with the Mustang convertible and the venue attendants sweep and smoke, which is what I love about Carrie, the cigarette she's smoking on the cover of New York Magazine a couple episodes earlier, single and fabulous, that shakes her confidence like a salsa. I read once that cigarettes punctuate your life. I've never smoked one, but I love more structure to my days, grammatical lilts that tell me when to fake the end and keep on going. Semicolon carcinogens are what I've been missing, along with eagle yellow irises and blood in my talons, fresh tear from the ribs of accountants or lawyers, the tenderest flesh to season the stew, like the collards my grandmother boils with hunks of low meat. She got married in New York, too, on a prototype reality TV show called American Wedding, with some New Yorker yammering in her ear, telling her to answer, "Where is Roseville?" with "About 20 miles from Branchville," to big laughs from the studio audience about these gorgeous hicks, their podunk lives. My occasional poem for her would have purple lipstick and cuss words. It would tell her she's fast and sexy, a falcon in a dive, bringing the skyline down with her. My husband is an engineer. I don't really know what he does. but he works with all of these women who are just incredible, and they intimidate me so much, and I'm so in awe of them, how they can do calculus and physics and such. So this poem is called "The Women My Husband Ought to Love." The women my husband ought to love are not all engineers per se, but they sway to silent music of codes, the strings of numerals that form the virtual coins he covets. Together they play a game of raising livestock. Avatars with frothy hair wiggle rakes over squares of a garden. When his avatar selects a wife, she comes with a surplus of cranberry wine and blue poultry. And they all clap, these women, as their crabbed fingers scroll the pencil skirts at Goodwill, ready to present bar graphs of third quarter savings. They stuff their bras with calculators and quake for statistics and angles. Each one comes with her own treadmill regimen of walk, run, sprint, recover, and none ever springs for the overpriced gym membership. Their skin is neon lycra, and when they run to buy milk or pay the electric bill. Not circular routes like clownfish in a tank, jogging shorts forever beneath their flame-retardant uniforms. Once we took a swing dance class, switching partners song by song, and I tapped the shoulder of one of these women as she rested her wrist on his waist. The instructor said, "Switch," I screeched, and she scurried away inside the circle, equations emitting from beneath her hair like steam, formulas dictating the length of children and duration of her career in chemical operations and management. Women my husband ought to love get up early and never wait for daylight. Each is assigned her own headlamp for applying mascara and chapstick only, so as not to raise his expectations too high, for they, like me, will inevitably age out of his love. But unlike me, they do not ask what he will do when this occurs, nor do they press his stomach and blow cool air in his face or pinch his nipples to force his answer. No, they are confident, mathematical girls, with no need for reassurance, no need to hear him whisper, "You'll always be beautiful," and certainly no block of ice in their chests, no chisel, no mothers, and no high heels, only infallible instruments that tell the exact weight and depth and circumference of his concrete lie. This is my last poem. It's a long one. But first I want to say thank you so much to the BARC for hosting the reading series, and to Madame Laurel and David Kirby for organizing it, and to Eleanor for her stunning introduction, and to Alexa for giving such a beautiful reading with me tonight. This poem is called Memos for My Mother. It's a series of sonnets that I wrote last spring. Memos for My Mother. At the top, the page said memos in green letters, and my mother, eight and sharp as fresh turned graphite, drew the crinkled face of a bulldog in the margins. Across the lines in slippery cursive, she cut her stories. Memis the bulldog picks up sticks. Memis goes to the beach. Memis gets a brand new puppy dog. Pronounced Memis, the dog found himself in mischief often as mom did. After pedaling fast through Mrs. Poodle's begonias, Memis first hid inside the cedar chest, but soon, after prayer, appeared on her front steps, arms spread wide, and cried his famous line, "I did it! Spank me, Mrs. Poodle!" As per the American Kennel Club's guidelines, a bulldog's demeanor should be pacific and dignified, not vicious or aggressive. The proper term for folds of the face is rump, and on average the bulldog lives 6 years and 3 months, plagued by cardiac struggles and its kingly weight. The University of Georgia keeps pure a sickly lineage of dogs named Ugga, likely first models for Memis, and in my abridged copy of Jack London's White Fang, I saw drawings of a bulldog dead clamped on the gray wolf's throat until a savior wedged a pistol through its jaws. The pug is the bulldog's most miniature kin, and my mother once lined 4, just born, like fat croissants on the bathroom floor. Their muzzles roped black like their mother, who panted rough beneath my sister's bed, where we found one last fawn puppy, slick and ancient-faced. In his last moments, my mother breathed into his slit, thin nostrils, placed a finger on his still, small chest, cried, for he had been the largest, the most viable, not a runt fated to be abandoned, denied milk while fuller siblings suck and keen. Just a first-time mother's shocked mistake. Finding herself spilled out, she waddled away. Like my grandfather, who last time I saw him chortled beneath my stout corgi on his withered chest, my mother cannot help herself around dogs. She holds their faces steady and pinches up their lips to make a snarl beneath placid eyes. She palms a rhythm on their sides. She lets the bird dog slither next to her on the leather couch and holds him while she naps. She even wipes the aging pug's folds with a Q-tip, laughs at memories of how her bolder maw and blunted canines would quell any violence in our house. After the first time, we'd fake spankings and yell for her to save us, fierce as any mother raptor. The day my mother slapped me for calling her a woman, We were in her bathroom, where before the light-soaked mirror, she tilted upside down to blow-dry damp brown hair, where she rolled lotion on firm golden legs, where we sidled in to seek approval of skirts and necklines, where the powder floated thick as moon dust, leaving a fresh layer shining on her blackest tights. And because it was there, she must have been naked. Breasts shaking with the force of her hand against my face. I think she did not like my dress. I think she did not like my tone, sarcastic and whiny, asking her, "What do you want from me, woman?" According to WikiHow, a memo should be direct, should eschew formal salutations, should end on a positive note that makes the recipient feel warmly towards the sender. Like his namesake, Memis's stories did not go for long, their tiny writer having learned too soon the virtues of brevity and succinctness, how excess must be trimmed. Siju tells us we need what we waste. To write is always to make allowances for superabundance and uselessness. The tiny writer did not waste. The sheets lined back in front with words, teaching Memis the bulldog what she knew. The corgi is known as a puppish beast, bred to boss the cattle, as its back grazed their udders and its teeth their haunches, so it is no surprise when my corgi plants his paws on evening walks, refuses to move on until he's claimed the patch of weeds or the neighbor's mailbox, lifted his curt leg to send his brisk message to the Yorkie down the street. And because I am known as my mother's daughter, with anger beneath my face that bursts quick as azaleas the first warm night of March, it is no surprise when I jerk his neck too hard and steer his sturdy body home. My mother tells me all the time she never felt slighted as a woman, a muscle in her jaw popping in and out like it does when she clenches her incisors tight on the neck of an argument about to ring it dead. Another time she told me how her father laughed when she told him she would not work, would probably just get married after college, and how she suspects that he had her schooled for that exact purpose. And she told me how, if my date touched me at the movies, I should gently take his hand in mine and place it on the armrest. No scene, no mess, just dark and quiet, like inside a shut mouth. Mother, I am searching for our breed in the catalog you keep by the bed. I try not to pound the coffee table when I argue with my husband, and I keep my voice so low and steady. And when I break and scream and stamp, I wonder if I am not fighting you. And if two women fighting cannot be a kind of love, too. I try to love my excess and my stillness, and I long to curl warm as the bird dog does against you, to have you examine my pointed teeth, want you to write my simple story, the one where I open my arms and know the punishment will end with people. Thank you.
Dishes back to the receptacles by the kitchen and join us next week. We'll hear from Robert Powers and Aaron Majority. Thanks for coming.